It's our great pleasure to welcome back once again Andy Ilichinsky to Lenswork Extended. Andy is a fascinating guy, very much an intellectual who challenges a lot of what we think, a lot of what we see. Every time I talk to him, I learn new things about photography, about perception, and seeing his work is, for me, always inspirational. This work is completely different from anything we've published of his before. And that's one of the things that I appreciate most about Andy Ilichinsky, his continual exploration of the world visually, his willingness to jump in and try new things and see where they lead him. And they lead him to some of the most interesting photographs we publish. Here's my interview with Andrew Ilichinsky about this fascinating body of work I'm not sure I can pronounce. Well, Andy, it's terrific to have you back in Lenswork again. This is actually your fourth appearance in Lenswork and Lenswork Extended. This time we're in Lenswork Extended only because it's color work. Both of these portfolios are. But I think the place that we have to start with this conversation is with something as mundane as terminology, because this is a bit of a tongue twister of a title coming from the words synesthesia. And my suspicion is that lots of people don't understand what the term synesthesia means. I'll confess, I had to look it up.
I'll confess that the people I've explained it to still stare at me with slack jaws. You know, what are you talking about?
Well, you know, what was fascinating is the minute I looked up the word in the dictionary and I had read your description and I looked it up and I thought, I know exactly what that is because it's an unusual term, but an experience that I think is understandable, even if we don't experience it ourselves.
My interest is comes to it, I guess, from a variety of angles. First, when I was a younger child, maybe up until 10 or 11, I distinctly remember having the most common form of synesthesia. And just to tell everybody listening, synesthesia is a crossing of the senses. The simple Greek derivative, you can look it up. But basically, it's when you taste what you see or you hear what you feel. And it's, you sort of, you know, you may look a little sideways at first when you hear it. For those who haven't experienced it, you know, what do you mean? And I mean that quite literally. You would see something and you would have, as normally, you know, just reacting to the visual stimuli, your sense of smell or hearing would be stimulated simultaneously. In my case, and the most common form, is when you see letters or numbers as colors. And it didn't happen to me more for letters, but for numbers, I would see even numbers as shades of blue and odd numbers as shades of red, which is perhaps in the back of my mind why I sent the warmth and the coolness, although there are other reasons. And it was a very palpable experience. It's one that, in some sense, colored, forgive the pun, when I was a young child. And I thought it was kind of neat, but I didn't really know much about it. And it basically disappeared. And I experience it rarely now, but not much. So anyway, for my entire life, I'm 52 now, I've been thinking about those kinds of themes, actually, even in my day job as a physicist. One of the things that I've done in the last couple of years is develop an idea to explore vast volumes of data. You know, data mining, that kind of big data is becoming a very hot topic. And the idea, without going into much detail, is can we lend a perspective on what otherwise is this possibly enormous, amorphous lump of data, of information, and have it assemble itself in ways that when we view it, either interactively or with some other automated program, it in a sense sort of crosses those boundaries of what we consider, you know, the standard conventional labels of, well, here's a graph, here's this, here's something in color, here's something that's moving. Can we exploit the fact that our brains are actually rather sophisticated pattern recognizers and use that to explore and search for otherwise latent or possibly invisible patterns? So I actually think about this stuff in my day job, and it's kind of crossed in its own way, kind of a pun. It's crossed senses in that way into my artistic life. And so we jump ahead a little bit, and up until about the 80s, in terms of people who study this sort of thing, and they're the pioneering researchers were at MIT. It's still around. A guy named Seidowich, for example. I've written a lot of blog entries on my blog, and I have references there. He recounts stories how up until we had the technology to actually do real-time imaging of the brain, people were studying people that were synesthetes, and there are a lot of famous ones. Nabokov, Richard Feynman, Scriabin, all through history. But depending on who you talk to, they either think they're charlatans or they take them at their word, but they're just creative types and that's not really what they're experiencing. And then the real-time imaging kicked in, and lo and behold, that's literally how synesthetes' brains interpret the world. The various parts of the brain that we associate with speech and visual, you know, the visual cortex and back and so on and so forth, multiple simultaneous parts of the brain are activated when synesthetes see the world. That's literally how they perceive things. And so synesthesia is a rather interesting phenomenon, and it afflicts by far more than people thought. People used to think it's like one in a million had it. And depending on the statistics you read nowadays, and again with the full weight of the medical imaging that we have, it's probably perhaps even as frequent as one in 100, to varying degrees, of course. So people should look out for it. It's not something to, you know, it's a flight of whimsy or whatever. It's a real palpable phenomenon. And it, my personal theory is that it's perhaps nature's way of probing what the best way to sense the world is. So there are all sorts of ways that the brain tries to organize the information. So that's a slightly long-winded answer to your question, but that's how it got started.
And this is different than the experience where we hear the wind and feel the wind. In that case, those are two separate sensual experiences of one.
Those are separate
thing.
Experiences using a single sense in both cases. Here, it's very difficult to describe in words, of course. Just imagine you're eating, a bologna sandwich. But as you're eating it, it's not just the tastes that you're experiencing. You are perhaps hearing something akin to a Beethoven sonata, or you're sensing something else. You know, you're being visually stimulated, and you see parts of the sandwich as almost radiating some hues and so on. It's a simultaneous experience of what otherwise and what most people experience through a single sensory channel.
Right.
So
right.
you and by the way, the evidence now exists that essentially all the possible crossings of senses of the five or six or however many we actually have, all of the possible crossings and multiple simultaneous ones, not just two crossings, but three crossings, four, and even when all the senses are activated simultaneously, very, very rare, but that happens. All of those simultaneous pathways exist and have been documented. So it's actually quite fascinating.
Well, I've said for a long time that one of the great challenges of photography is to get beyond the visual.
Sure.
That is to say, yeah. We would hope that when someone looks at a photograph, one of our photographs, what they have is an experience that is not just, gee, aren't those lovely tones, but that it somehow strikes a chord so that they think something, they see something different, so that it engages perhaps in a different sense. I've even gone so far as to say that this is one of the advantages of multimedia, that we can engage more than one sense at a time. What you're describing with this process is not where we have more than one sense gets coalesced in the brain to create a single impression, but literally that we have one experience that creates multiple impressions in the brain.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, and an alternative way, basically restating what you said, perhaps in even more simple fashion, is I've explained to people in workshops and little classes that if you think about it on a very, very fundamental level, what does any art try to do? And of course, everybody has their favorite answer, but to me, what's at the top of the list, particularly when I try to teach beginning photographers, the people who first pick up a point and shoot and they go out and take, you know, a picture of their family, friends, or the bush in the front yard, I say photography is ultimately about doing whatever it is you need to do with that thing you're holding in your hand so that when you give it to someone, and it may be different, it may be a computer screen image, it may be a print, whatever it is, but that final product that somebody else will see, your task as a photographer slash artist is to try to convey whatever information is necessary, perhaps tailored to the individual you're going to show it to, so that when that individual sees that final object, there's at least a hint of a possibility of experiencing some of the state, your emotional state, when you were taking the photograph. Now, easy to say in words, of course, and I'm not sure the extent to which it captures all of art, but I think it touches on a core aspect of what all good art is, that you're obviously not just showing in a documentary fashion, here's where I was and here's what I see, here's why I took that photograph. But to do that, you have to both understand and try to navigate those very complicated waters of the fact that we're very complex beings. We're not just visual beings. When we're in a state somewhere, particularly as photographers, what compels us to press that button at a certain point? I mean, think about all of the enormity of that huge multidimensional space that's acting on you on an intuitive level, right? Mm-hmm. Where you came from, your history, what you feel, what you're hearing, everything. And so in that sense, synesthesia at least becomes a way to, in some relatively well-defined, you know, way, think about the processing that goes into that. What does it really mean? And can you exploit that to communicate some of that feeling to another human being? So again, that was part of why this project remains a very interesting one for me. I mean, I mentioned in the last part that I wrote to you guys that it's probably something that I won't ever stop doing. Every time, you know, my wife comes home with another little colored cup, I always give it a little bit of a look, and I may go downstairs for a couple of minutes to look for stuff, because it's so fun to do, and because it's just something that really tugs at me, that I can look at a glass and I can have somebody else proclaim, "My God, where were you? Did you see the Aurora Borealis?" Well, yes and no.
Yeah, right. Now let's sort of put our cards on the table here, though, because I don't want people to get sidetracked into thinking that what you're intending these photographs to do is to create one of these synesthesia experiences, so that if they don't feel that, they feel like somehow your photographs have failed. That's not the purpose of this work.
Yeah, the synesthetic here, this is like a baby experiment at synesthesia, right, at best. I just thought it was a nice theme to throw out. The baby step is that what this project represents is an attempt to take something which by itself in a conventional form would elicit nothing other than the very banal, "Oh, this is what I'm looking at" kind of thing. I'm looking at a bottle. And to use that photographically to try to instill within the viewer kind of a sense of awe of something, some possibility for something that is obviously not of this banal character, and I hope some of these images evoke these, you know, vast vistas of tormenting oceans, or some, you know, on the warm side, maybe some desert kind of landscapes in the Sahara. And so the synesthesia simply comes from the crossing of the senses of looking or using one reality depicted in a certain way that would otherwise be interpreted in a very simple way, kind of a one-dimensional way, but presented in such a way that it evokes at least the baby step impression of being so much more.
Yes.
And that's all. It's just a baby step. So the synesthesia is kind of a catch-all phrase that I think is a nice, you know, wrap around a broad bird's eye view of what the project represents, and it should be interpreted on its own terms. But that's all it is, of course, at this level.
Well, it does that for me in the sense that when I first looked at these, my immediate impression was that they were quite musical, quite lyrical. Obviously, there's the movement involved in what you've captured here, and that helps that feeling. But they're very definitely scapes in the mental sense more than they are, you know, like a landscape. Now, obviously, that leads you to this rather tongue-twisting word.
Well, originally they were just called synesthetic landscapes, and perhaps I should have left them at that. And I wanted a one word to capture both synesthesia and scapes. It's my poor man's attempt, and I admit that it's far from the best, and I can't really pronounce it very well myself.
Well, that's okay. We'll just read it. We won't pronounce it.
There you
Those
go.
Of us who are lip readers, that's our problem, right? It's also, I think, important to note that you're not doing something that hasn't been explored by other artists, and in particular other photographers, one of whom has been a tremendous influence on you.
Wynne Bullock, that's a story in itself, and I think in the next coming decade or so, when I move on to other things, I'll always think of Wynne Bullock first when I think of my synesthetic landscapes. Let me tell you the short little story. I started these landscapes, you know, in a series of pictures which you don't see in this portfolio, as all things evolve, and then you move on to something you like a little better. But it dates back about 3.5-4 years to 2009. I was sitting with my family at my in-law's place in Florida for Thanksgiving, and my mother-in-law had brought out these metallic, twisted, kind of nambe, if you know the designer's name, shapes for salt and pepper shakers, and I saw the reflections of the various bits of furniture and the light she had on the ceiling, and I was mesmerized by the reflections, and I started taking pictures. That's where this started. But I soon tired of that because it was kind of all pretty much the same, and I started moving into this, let's look for these translucent objects, colored objects. Well, about 2 or 3 months into this, I had, maybe a little later, maybe my timing is off, but we can look at the history later. At some point, a couple of months later, I got wind of, just by chance, of a new book of color photographs by one of the people that has been, from a photographic standpoint, very instrumental in my development, even though I never met him, Wynne Bullock. My absolute cherished masters were Ansel Adams, Minor White, and Wynne Bullock. I mean, those are the top three, and mm-hmm. I continue learning from them. And I ran across this book that startled me, because I know Wynne, as I suspect many other people do, from his black and white work. And of course, for my part, you can understand the resonance, because Wynne had a penchant for musings about space and time and relativity. He was not a physicist, and he got a lot of his musings wrong, but the fact that he mused was so wonderful. One of the deep laments of my life is that I never got a chance to sit and chat with him, but that's where the story is leading, because in a sense I did. So let me get there. So I ran across this book. There was an advertisement for a book called Wynne Bullock, Color Light Abstracts. I said, what the heck is that? I never knew that Wynne did anything with color. I mean, this was back in the 60s. His daughter, Barbara Bullock Wilson, his eldest daughter, she both, I guess, administers to his artistic estate, does his website, and she was instrumental in putting this book together, lovingly. It was published, I guess, 1-2 years ago or so. And indeed, the story is that in the early 60s, right around the time that I was coming out of the womb, I was born in 1960, Wynne had been experimenting for about 5 or 6 years with these extraordinary color abstracts. And he built what I think his daughter called the Bullock block in his basement. On her website, she has this wonderful photograph of these layered cakes of brick in between which he'd put these glass, glass layers. And he put all sorts of weird stuff there. He was friends with an astronomer from Mount Palomar, for example, and he got all these rumbled up and grungy lenses and so on. And he'd sit there for hours just looking for interesting things. And my, did he find them. You've seen the book, I imagine, right?
Oh, yeah. It's fabulous work and very, very unknown.
And it's unknown primarily because he lived in a time when, this is way before digital and color was only coming into its own, he couldn't find the right color reproduction. And so except for the few friends and guests to when he gave lectures using slides and putting them up on a wall or whatever, nobody really knew he even did it. And so it took all this time, and it was just published as a couple of years ago. I was absolutely stunned. I was delighted that they were very different from the ones I was doing, and in a very different way. In many ways, I have a much, much simpler approach to this. I just don't have the time to devote to it. It's basically weekends and when I'm not too tired when I get back home from work. But I was absolutely mesmerized. And so I actually emailed, and I had to order the book through Wynne Bullock's website. So I emailed Barbara Bullock Wilson. She answered in person. And to sort of make a slightly longer story short, we became friends over email. We're now good Facebook friends. She asked me to provide a guest commentary. One of the things she has on the website is every month she puts up a photograph, some of them not ever revealed before. And she invites, every once in a while, usually she does it, but she invites somebody to make a comment about this photograph, whatever they want. It could be, in my case, it was about 10 minutes long, and I left an audio track there. That was a highlight for me. That was about a year and a half ago or so. And as I say, I became a friend with Wynne Bullock's daughter. And so when she saw the first post that I put in my blog from the Synesthetic Landscape series, she left a series of very warm and very positive statements. You know, oh, my dad would have so enjoyed this. He would have blah, blah, blah. And so in that sense, I feel that kind of a bridge over time has been established. As I say, I'm very sincere about how I deeply, deeply lament not having an opportunity, really, to meet these three particular masters, some of which there are others, like Carl Chiarenza, for example. It took me a lot of nerve to finally look him up on Facebook and leave an email. This is kind of a side story in itself, but partly influenced by the fact that I have this lament about not meeting people like Minor White and Wynne Bullock. And he was so kind, he sent an email immediately back. And in fact, he told me, oh, you're the guy with the micro worlds and lens work. That was good work. That meant the world to me. I mean, I was, oh, that, I just to say that that made my week, you know, that's an understatement. But in terms of this work, to get that kind of response from Barbara Bullock Wilson, that served the same purpose. It warms my heart. So that was just a wonderful little side story of this project.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have always felt, and particularly feel strongly now as a publisher, is that photography is a form of conversation between artists. And that conversation spans generations. It spans decades. The fact that you never met Wynne Bullock doesn't mean that you can't have an artistic conversation with him. And who knows, there will be someone 30, 40 years from now who will have a conversation with you. That's one of the magic parts of photography and one of the reasons why I'm such a strong advocate of teaching the history of photography to young photographers, to new photographers. And unfortunately, you know, that's not always the case.
Yeah, in fact, you remind me of another little theme I wanted to touch on, although it's not necessarily about the synesthetic landscapes per se. One of the last blog entries I added on my blog was about the lament, again, although in a more general sense, of the greater difficulty I suspect that younger photographers have nowadays of connecting with the older wisdom that shouldn't be forgotten, but in an era of ebooks. And one of the things I mentioned there is something that I noted you had written in the Lenswork Daily about some young photography student who, when you asked about Edward Weston, basically just raised an eyebrow and said, what, who? That's unforgivable in my book, but it's also a very, very sad truth of the modern era. I don't know whether, you know, you and I are just old fogies and our time has passed. I don't think so. There is a great deal of wisdom to be culled from masters that still live in the art, as you say. And when I see, and obviously when you see, kind of a decline, a dilution of that knowledge, it's just very sad.
Yeah, it is. I did an e-consultation several months ago with a guy who had an interesting portfolio of the Slit Canyons. And we were talking about it, and I said, well, of course, one of the challenges you're going to have with this work is it's going to be compared immediately to the work of Bruce Barnbaum, who pioneered all this kind of stuff. And predictably, you know, he said, who?
Right. Unbelievable.
And he thought he had discovered something that no one had ever done before.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, that's one of the great challenges, but one that, you know, we can't worry too much about because we're too busy trying to create our own work.
On a happy note, actually, one of the three examples I cite on the happy side of the news, as it were, on that same blog entry is, you mentioned Bruce Barnbaum. I got one of the first or second editions of his The Way of Photography, it's called, or something, you know, the book that basically he's been working on since the 70s. And it used to be just something that you would get privately, you email him and so on, which is what I did a long, long time ago. It's this dog-eared copy. There are no pictures in it. It's just straight text, and he refers you to other sources where you can get the pictures. But it's just this wonderful encapsulation of, and it's obviously evolving over this very gifted photographer printer's worldview. And as I say, the happy note is, you probably know this through, what's the Rocky Nook series of books?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Bruce has the updated version of that, which I'm sure you know about.
Yeah,
but even on a happier note, there's a beautiful version, not perfect, but it's a version that's actually a steal for like $10 for the Kindle.
Yeah,
and so
right. There's
still this the pleasant side of the modern era. You still have to know what you look for, and you have to look for it. But here's this extraordinary resource that every young photographer should avail themselves of, and it's $10 for a Kindle, but it is available.
Right.
That's the beauty. So there is hope.
Yeah. I want to go back to how this project started and have you explain a little bit about what you're actually doing without giving away too many trade secrets. But there was a quote that fascinated me. Just as a quick little aside, in your text, you mentioned this salt shaker that you saw at the family dinner. And then you said this. You said, and I'm quoting, "Naturally, I spent the remaining part of our trip playing with the macro lens with which I always travel.
Yes.
And I thought, now there's a photographer who doesn't go anywhere without a macro lens.
I think all photographers can relate to that, and they probably have a silent chuckle to the consternation of their wives. My usual travel gear, and I try to make it as light as possible, is I have a zoom lens that I pack in for all occasions, going to the beach and walking up and down the street. But my love for the, I guess dating back to the Microworld series, is I'm always on the look for interesting things close up. And so I have this wonderful lens that only Canon makes, so I'm delighted that I'm a Canon camera user, the MPE65. I mean, it's ostensibly a 65mm lens, but as a macro, it only starts where other macros end. So you start with a life-size reproduction, it goes up to 5x. And it's to say it's my favorite lens for this kind of work would be a massive understatement. It's basically the only lens I use, and there's no other that can either compete or take its place. I don't believe, I don't want to be wrong about this, but I don't believe Nikon or any of the others, actually even Zeiss, that they make anything approaching this. I may be wrong about that, but as a macro lens, it's stellar. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I do, yes. It's a fabulous lens.
It's incredible. So that's my traveling companion. It's not that heavy. It's just another lens in the bag. And I truly never travel without it. Mm. And it's you can appreciate how, imagine you're cooped up in a hotel room, let's say, and it's although normally I like miserable weather, obviously, but if it's too miserable and you don't want to go out, you still can do an enormous amount indoors. And so I'm never at a loss.
Yeah. Now, the work that we're seeing here in this Cinescapes, both the variations of it, coolness and warmth, these are not, however, straight macro photography. You're doing other things than just pointing your camera at something small and making a picture.
Not really. It is. I mean, the answer is it is, the short answer. They're obviously out of focus, at least at the point where the focal plane is. Mm-hmm. Usually at around f2.8, f3.5. That's deliberate. But apart from that, it is nothing other than that macro lens pointed at a variety of objects, as simple as, I've already alluded to, a colored glass. The trick is it should have some kind of undulating shape so you can have interesting reflections and scatterings of light. It could be, I've done a lot of whiskey bottles, the bottoms of them. I've stacked various glasses and I've put them, you know, near each other in a variety of configurations with a variety of light sources. About half of it is sunlight. I've done flashlights and floodlights and a variety of other things. So it sometimes gets somewhat more complicated in my arrangements, but to be honest, the simpler the better, because the attempts to find something are just that. I sit there and I can imagine, again, with this bridge to Wynne Bullock, and from the descriptions of his daughter, it's pretty much the same. It's nothing more magical or more mysterious than sitting with this sometimes cumbersome set of objects in front of you with various streams of light going back and forth and looking for things. And of course, you're looking at a very, very tiny space. I mean, probably a fraction of a fingernail. And it's very transient. I mean, if the light shifts or if the cloud goes, everything's gone. And that's actually part of the fun as well. I love that transience. There's something magical in that I know that whatever shot I've taken, I lean back in my chair, and if I've moved my tripod a tiny bit or if I've breathed too heavily with particularly the higher magnifications, I'll never find it again. It's gone. But there's really nothing more mysterious than that. So in that sense, it's a straight macro shot, just not necessarily in focus. And I'm not showing you anything other than what the light itself gives, which is something that Wynne would have resonated with. The light becomes the substance. It's arguably the purest form of photography.
So by way of explanation, we should also emphasize that these are not Photoshop constructions as such.
No, they're not at all. The only thing that I will admit to, and I just like the presentation, I deliberately put all of them into a square format. That's the only real Photoshop trick. So all of them are from a standard, you know, Canon, so some of them are lengthwise and some of them portrait. And I deliberately put them into a square because I didn't want the shape or the orientation to play into just observing this entire sequence as one body of work, and I wanted them all square. But that's the only thing that I did digitally to them. Otherwise, it's basically a straight shot. Very little correction. I pumped up the usual, you know, contrast curves and so on, but there's no Photoshop trickery at all.
Yeah. I think this is perhaps the first time I've ever heard of cropping as a Photoshop trick.
Well, Photoshop trick in the sense, it's not a crop, but I shifted the perspective.
Right.
So that's not something that would have been easy to do in the analog world, but that's the only thing that I've done that's pure digital to it.
Right.
Otherwise, it's really a straight shot. That's pretty much what I saw.
And the two portfolios, Warmth and Coolness, are obviously determined based on their color palette.
On my blog, I actually called them and I played with this, and this was my wife's idea, I believe. She said, "Let's not get too tricky here. Don't start philosophizing, because she knows my Bullock-like penchant for that." Originally, they were called Intuition and Cognition. And the intuition was the fire, the warmth, and the intellect was the cool. But that was the original idea.
Uh-huh.
And there I liked it because it also gave a slightly deeper layer to synesthesia, because now we're crossing the boundaries of kind of interpretation with the artistry. And you're deliberately injecting kind of, but again, you see, I'm already off the deep end. I don't want to over intellectualize this, so let's just keep it at warmth and coolness. But that's where my thinking lay.
It's very possible we might have leapt beyond the deep end when we started by talking about synesthesia.
That's possible, yeah.
But what I wanted to emphasize here was that the coloration of these images are based on the light that you were observing, the object you were photographing, not wildly playing with color and saturation controls, which would be so easy to do, but just a different sort of thing when you're actually finding it in the real world.
I must have probably half a dozen staples, plastic, you know, those stackable boxes with all sorts of colored objects. There are blue, there are purple, there are green. I have a whole different series, which kind of is a synesthetic landscape of, you know, these undulating fields, wheat fields, and so on. And they're all color-coded, and they're, you know, labeled in different ways. But I have my different universes in different bottles and different boxes. So, yeah, that was not part of the Photoshop trickery.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about your approach to the editing process. I would imagine you probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of these.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in time, you've got to look at an image and say in, out, yes, no, etc., before you make that final decision that says, this is the project as I want to send it out into the world and have it be seen. How do you go about that process of editing, and how do you make the determinations about which ones you keep and show, and which ones you file away and say, not quite?
Well, I'll give you several answers, cutting to the last and most important one. It's not necessarily a perpetually ongoing process. I mean, at some point the project will end, but that culling process is truly a very continuous curve. I mean, there's no magic point where I finish one folder and I say, all right, I'm done with that. Those are the keepers and I'm moving on to the next. I'll get into the details in a second. I continually live with these. It's kind of the digital analog of having pictures plastered on your wall, and which are the ones that you can live with for however long a period of time. I continually look at them, and my tastes change, and the relationship of one to another changes, and the categories, as they should, of evolving into, for example, it may seem obvious in hindsight, well, why not have the warmth and coolness and others? It wasn't obvious to me. This was something that kind of self-organized after a period of maybe 2 years or so. I used to have something like over a dozen folders, and I had very specific tags. This was the Aurora Borealis. This was this, or Aurora Borealis-like images. And it just wasn't working. So that's self-organized, but it's just this continual process. On a more pragmatic level, it's kind of on-off. By on, I mean for about a week or two, I'll be doing nothing but taking pictures. And for the week after that or so, I'd be processing them, I'd be labeling them, and otherwise trying to distill this list, and then I'd go back and the cycle will continue. This has been going on for several years now. The rough statistics are, I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but it's something on the order of, for every hour or two of searching, in which I may take I don't know, 100, 200 shots, maybe 2, 3, or 4 will be keepers in the sense that I will actually process them in my processing period, and I'll put them into a side folder that I will then continually look back on. The good side about that is that, well, it's an orderly process, and it paved the way to having, I think, a nice portfolio or two. The bad part of that is I have an enormous number of images that are always going to be there in my hard drive and that I can actually, I do look back on, but I don't do it as regularly. Right. And so there may be a bunch of things there, but again, that's nothing unique to this project or anyone else working in the digital world. That's just a perpetual fact. I mean, you're going to be looking at stuff 10 years ahead of time that you would have thought to yourself, my God, why didn't I do anything with that at the time? Well, you didn't for whatever reason. So that is a problem. But I've kept this schedule more or less regularly for the entire time I've done it. Take pictures, process, keep a relatively small fraction for every period of time in which I'm taking pictures and processing. But those pictures that I keep always refer back to. That's the set that I will always continue to work back on. And initially, again, just as a crude kind of statistical overview of this whole thing, is maybe after a year's worth of effort, I would have something like 200 images that were these keepers. But in the next year, 100 of them would go away because others would be added. They didn't fit together well enough. And in that way, it keeps flowing. And then 6 months after that, maybe another 30 or 40% of that whole set would go away. A few would be replaced by some new ones. So that entire keeper folder is a continually massaged keeper set. Mm-hmm. And at the end of two and a half years, what you're looking at are not necessarily the best of the bunch. In fact, I have a couple of other portfolios that are more greenish. They're more yellowish, but not quite in the same way as the warmth. So there are a variety of others. But this is at the end of 2, 3 years of effort. And these are just the ones that I particularly like as a sequence, as a flow. And that's something, by the way, you've taught me and Lenswork has taught me. Before I became a very serious reader of Lenswork, I was, as I suspect many photographers continue to be, it's just that I've just found that the Lenswork model works better for me. I'm no longer content with what I used to do, which is just, well, here's a picture, here's a picture, here's a picture. I've grown tired of that. It doesn't satisfy me as a still budding photographer artist. And the Lenswork model, where you think on a slightly higher level, you're trying to tell a story with a sequence of images. The images, how they fit together, even relative to one another, side by side on a page, is part of the overall story that no single image can capture. That's something that Lenswork has taught me, and actually that has fueled what I've done with this project, because that's part of my workflow. It's not just working on the images. I probably spend, and this is an honest, sincere assessment, even as I'm sort of talking off the top of my head here, I spend probably as much time sequencing and looking at entire screenfuls of images and how they fit together and making decisions on what to keep and not than I do actually working on the individual images. And that's kind of a telling comment. That's just a different way, or it's a way of how I approach photography, which may be different, I guess, from others.
Well, you mentioned 2 years. You know, the other side of that coin is the challenge of losing spontaneity when you make a project in 2 years. I have to admit, I'm always torn between these two, because I love the idea of, well, to pull out an obscure reference, a Japanese poet like Ryokan, who would write poetry off the top of his head instantaneously, as compared to, you know, Shakespeare, who might take months to write a sonnet. Both of those end up with brilliant pieces of work, but they're entirely different methods. And, you know, I find myself sometimes as an artist struggling. Should I hang on to this one and let it evolve over time, or am I better to let it to publish it, to get it out into the world instantly so it's a reflection of my spontaneous creation now? And that's a constant battle, I think, for an artist. And ultimately, what you're going to end up doing is making commitments to either be spontaneous or to be meditative, and you're going to live or die by the results, because neither of those methods are ultimately a sole method for success.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, I think we all have, multiple projects that evolve simultaneously. They overlap, and there are frustrations that are inherent in that, and you've mentioned a few. I've also found solace in some of them. For example, even as I was doing the Luray stuff, which was a very different kind of thing, it's sort of it took a long time to evolve. But the whole project itself lasted one day, 9 hours in one day, but it was one day. But in hindsight, even as I was doing the Luray, I was immersed in this synesthetic landscape. And the fact that I was able to get away and for a short burst of time devote all of whatever creative juices that I had onto one project having nothing to do with the synesthetic landscapes, that actually helped the synesthetic landscapes because I got away from it for a while. So there are ways in which you can exploit what otherwise would be pure frustration, because it does give your mind the chance to relax from one thing. And that's something I know of going back to our earliest conversations with the micro worlds. I do live in these two very different worlds. In my day job, I'm literally losing my eyesight over the reams of equations and computer code I'm working in. And it's a very different environment from being behind the camera. So that when I get behind the camera, I am just filled with this joy that I have this other world that I can forget the other one in. And by the same token, I think it helps my photography that I'm a little away, and while my brain is struggling with the equations and the code, my brain is still my brain. And there are these artistic sensibilities which perhaps even as we sleep, for example, right? The reason for sleep, at least some people think, is that the brain needs that time to sort of put its packages on the shelves and organize itself for the next day's event. So when I'm working with my equations, even though I'm not doing my photography is still being served because that part of the brain can relax and sleep. And so if one is a photographer and not a scientist, so if you don't have those two worlds, you can still have a semblance of that by having very different types of work and very different approaches to the different works you have. Because that again, it allows that those other parts of your brain that when you're doing something spur of the moment, that would ordinarily be doing something on a much more sedate level and whatnot, well, it's resting and it's also getting its a fair share in a sense of that creative space that you've managed to somehow cobble together.
That's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that until you just mentioned it. The work you were referring to from Luray, by the way, was for Lenswork readers, was the portfolio you titled "As Above, So Below," which we published in Lenswork number 95. And in that case, you were down in an underground cave system, and there you were making black and white images that were extremely contrasty. At least the subject was extremely contrasty, not the images resulted in, but a very different sort of thing. And what you ended up creating there was things that looked like they were a small world sometimes, even though they were huge caverns. So you were playing with perspective and in black and white and with high contrast. It's interesting that exactly the same time you're saying you were working on this body of work, that is working with very small things and making them look very large, working in color with almost no detail. They're just
But
about as opposite as they could be.
the physical approach was very, very different. And I think that ultimately helped both bodies of work. I mean, the more I think about it as I'm speaking, I think that's really true. That you can't, or at least I can't, so myopically focus on this one thing for a prolonged period of time because then truly the creative spark goes. I mean, at some point it just gets bored and it leaves. And so if I have these multiple threads, not all of which are going to come to fruition, I mean, all of us, I presume, are the same way. Even Ansel Adams said a good year he'd have 10 photographs or something. Maybe 10 of my attempts at doing something, one of them comes through and then I persist at it. But I need those multiple threads. If I didn't have them, I think I'd never stop doing photography, of course, but it would become more, I don't know, it would have an element of boredom to it, which I never want to succumb to.
Well, it's just a terrific body of work, and it's, I think, doubly interesting that we can compare this to the work that we've published from you earlier. I've mentioned on numerous occasions with photographers that one of the things we love to do in Lenswork is to go back and republish photographers who we've published earlier. We almost give a preference to alumni because we like to show that that creative process is one that evolves and changes, and it helps us keep photographers from getting pigeonholed. You know, I'd hate for you to be the guy who's known in the world as the guy who photographs plastic candle holders, you know,
right.
There's more than that. And it's just terrific to see this body of work and to have these comparisons, and always a delight to talk with you. I actually spend more time with you than you know, because I am a dedicated blog reader. I think you've got one of the best photo blogs going, always interesting to read. And I definitely want to give that a plug and recommend our readers go to that. What is the URL address for that again?
Just do Tao Photography blog. Just do a search on that and it's the first one that comes up. So T-A-O, Tao Photography and blog. I should probably have chosen a different name, but that was way back when. I kept with it. So this is a Tao Photography, Tao Digital Photography.
Well, it's a terrific blog, and you're a fascinating guy to talk with, Andy. Thanks again for allowing us to share this work.
Thanks, Brooks. Always a pleasure.
Copyright 2013, Lenswork Publishing.